This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January 25th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm going to be bringing you some of the developments that have occurred this week in the area of federal taxes. And we have a few things happening this week, one of which, by the way, is going to be a little bit of change in how we're recording here. So we're going to be recording under a slightly different system. I'm hoping that everything sounds fine and we don't have any problems. We're going to try this out so we can maybe do a few different things going forward in the future. But let's get started with what's happening this week. And let's start with our first development here, which comes around and looks at issues that impact a taxpayer who establishes a qualified retirement plan. This is the case of Family Chiropractic Sports Injury and Rehab, Inc. versus Commissioner, Tax Memorandum Decision 2016-10, issued on January 19, 2016 by the Tax Court. This issue involves an entity. This was a corporation. It was a chiropractic corporation. Then it was owned by 100% by a husband and wife. The husband and wife were both participants in an employee stock ownership plan that was established by the chiropractic corporation. An ESOP, like any other type of retirement plan, has to comply with certain rules. There actually are a couple of things you got to worry about. When you establish a plan, number one, you have to establish a plan with a plan document that provides that the plan will be operated in accordance with the requirements of federal law to comply with both the rules under ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code. Now, your plan document will also have other, make selections of provisions. Your plan document, therefore, as long as your document doesn't violate the law, then you're fine. Okay, that's halfway. The other half is an operational side of the equation. That is, even though we've got the world's most perfect document, if we don't operate the plan in accordance with that document, then we also don't have a qualified plan. If you don't have a qualified plan, you don't get the benefits that Congress gives you with a qualified plan, that benefit being primarily that we are able to defer income into the plan, so the corporation gets a deduction for funding the plan on behalf of the taxpayer, and in this case, his spouse, because they were the two participants in the plan. But those two do not have to pick it up as income until many years down the line when they take distributions from the plan. That's a wonderful deferral scheme, deferral being one of the major ways we handle tax planning. But the problem is you've got to comply with the rules or you lose it. When Congress gives you a break that's different than what you get under the normal rules, you've got to comply with those rules, or Congress generally responds to that by saying you lose your break. In this case, our problem came up when the spouses got divorced. The husband and wife, you know, got divorced. He was a chiropractor. She's not. As part of the divorce, they basically never mentioned this plan initially. Generally, here's the problem with qualified plans and divorces. Under the rules applicable to qualified retirement plans, you have to meet what's called have an anti-alienation provision in the plan. That's a long way of saying that, you know, the very thing we know about plans is that they are protected from the claims of creditors. The plan provides that, in fact, you can't, no other third party can reach in there and transfer the balance from the participant. And that basically the plan has to assure that those balances stay as they are in the plan, as they're meant to be in a plan, and no third party can reach in. We realize that people do get divorced and the retirement plan may be a significant balance and may be a significant asset of the married couple. Because of that, federal law provides a special set of rules that must be followed for a qualified retirement plan. A qualified retirement plan balance is going to be transferred from one participant to another, or one participant to that participant's spouse, even that spouse is not a participant, under the guides of a qualified domestic relations order. Generally, a quadro has to meet certain requirements in order to be a quadro. So it has to be technically written correctly, and it has to be issued by the state court. So the state court issues that as part of the marital breakup generally, and it has to be properly drafted. So normally we need to have an attorney who is skilled in ERISA issues involved at the same time as we have the family law attorney involved in the divorce. And we get a qualified domestic relations order. Unfortunately for these two, they didn't do that. What they did was, after the divorce was final, the divorce itself never mentioned the plan, the wife transferred, her entire balance was transferred to the husband inside the plan. No qualified domestic relations order, no other issue. As you may expect, the plan itself says we can't transfer balances between individual people in the plan or to any third party. But they did it. Now, their thought probably is, well, it was our money anyway. Remember, Congress gave a break. That means you've got to follow the rules. And if they start thinking too much that it's their money, that's usually your first key indicator that you may have problems with these people running the plan. What happened in this case was the IRS challenged the plan's qualification, and the tax court, looking at the situation, said, you know, you violated the plan document. You violated the rules under these plans. Because you didn't operate in accordance with the document, this is not, and the way this is viewed is, therefore your plan fails to be operated in accordance with a definite written instrument since you're ignoring it. Apparently there's these side agreements that aren't in the plan that you're using. That gets rid of the written requirement. Because of that, the plan is killed. And here's what the real bad news is. It's killed for the year in which you have the problem, plus every subsequent year is killed at the same time. The plan does not spring back to life. That means, of course, that there is no qualified retirement plan. That means that the assets inside the plan, their earnings are subject to tax. It also means that if it's transferred and now it's been transferred to the control of somebody, that's subject to tax. The old amounts that were in the plan effectively distributed. There's lots of bad things that happen in this case. Remember, your clients have to follow the rules if you adopt a qualified retirement plan. Next up, another problem we have here with basically employee benefits, this time in the case of a stock option program. This is an IRS Chief Counsel Advice 2016-03025. And this dealt with basically a stock option that was granted to somebody in a company, and the company was not yet having its stock traded over the counter, but there were outstanding at the time this was issued, outstanding were contracts that could be purchased that would allow people to purchase the stock when it was finally issued on the over-the-counter market. The value they gave, now here's our hitch. Under 409 Cap A, a stock option program generally is not considered to be a non-qualified deferred compensation arrangement subject to the rules of 409 Cap A. 409 Cap A imposes nasty penalties if you fail to meet it, not the least of which is a 20% penalty tax on top of the regular tax for the value of the deferral, as well as immediate inclusion income of the value of the deferral. But the other problem is it says, well, if you have a stock option program where the strike price when you give the option is no greater than, is basically equal to at least the fair value of the stock, that's not considered to result in deferred compensation. If my stock is selling for $100 and I give you a right to buy it for $100 for the next 5 years, we're not going to worry about the fact that you have a right to maybe in the future to get it cheaper. Today, there is no value transferred. And under the general rules of Section 83, we don't recognize that as long as the option is not traded in the public market and there's no income. But we still have the problem that if we instead, that stock selling at 100, I give you an option today to buy that stock at 70, that does create current deferred compensation because I can buy it at a discount. You know, I've got my discounts already in place. I've got it cheap. So I've got it below the market price. In this case, they were saying, well, we don't really need to worry about this because basically, you know, the question is what the price should be determined. Generally, if the stock is traded on an over-the-counter public market, the fair value is considered to be that. Well, they said, wait. Our option is not currently traded on the market. And so we had somebody give us a value that said it was worth less than the contract price on the market. The IRS had two objections to this. First, the IRS said the mere fact there's a contract to purchase stock on the over-the-counter market means that effectively the stock can be purchased on the over-the-counter market, means you have to use that value. But even if you claim the publicly traded stock rule doesn't come into play for valuing it under the regulations that we have involved here on the 409 Cap A regulations found at regulation 1.49 Cap A-1 B5I Cap A, even if you claim that doesn't apply, you still have to consider all relevant information in coming up with your value. And the valuation never considered the value of the fact that there were people paying contract prices to buy when issued that were higher than the option price being granted this person. So even if we said it wasn't the fair market, even the market rule didn't apply, you couldn't ignore these contracts, which is what they did. So for that reason, the chief counsel advice says, and they're advising, obviously, exam to take the position, that this was a deferred comp arrangement, that this deferred comp arrangement didn't satisfy 409 cap A. That's almost for certain. If you didn't think it was a problem, you probably didn't write it in such a way so that it wouldn't. And so because of that, obviously, there's going to be a claim of assessing tax against the recipient of the option plus assessing the penalty. Be very careful in this realm, you know, and watch it in this area. Next up, we have some guidance here because Congress put in some new rules for 501c4 organizations. And the IRS has now delayed the effective date or delayed the date for new 501c4 organizations to file statements required by the Protecting Americans Against Tax Hikes Act. This was found in Notice 2016-9 issued on January the 19th. 501c4s have been all over the news, as you may remember. This is what caused the big to-do in the exempt organizations group of the IRS. This is where all those deleted email issues came from. Okay, this has become a nasty area. 501c4 organizations are generally social welfare organizations, and they have the ability to be used to some extent for political purposes. And there we get to that whole long thing, which we won't talk about here. But because of that, a C4 organization technically, under the prior law, did not have to actually apply for exemption, nor did it notify the IRS it existed. Under the new rules that we have here, effective for this year, effective now, effective for organizations that begin operating after December 18th, which was the date that the PATH bill came into law, or certain organizations, other organizations, in general, that's going to be ones that convert over and now become C4, claim to operate under C4 at a later date. They need to file a notification to the IRS that they plan to operate as a C4. The IRS will send an acknowledgement of that notification to the organization. The problem is, of course, currently we have no mechanism yet to file those notifications. The IRS has now provided that any organization that is covered by that, that is generally going to be those formed after December 18th, those organizations do not need to file this notification until 60 days after the regulations are issued. Those organizations will still have to file a notice. So if you have somebody who creates a 501c4 today, you don't have to file until the regs are issued. Once the regs are issued, you're going to have to meet the deadline for filing that notification. So that organization has got to be aware of when those things come down. As well, there's another issue here. They get an acknowledgement. When the IRS acknowledges that you gave them notice, the IRS is not ruling you are a C4 organization. They will come up with mechanisms to do that as well as part of this. But for now, what the IRS has said is that if you want to be a C4, you still have to go ahead and those organizations who want to have a ruling today, go ahead and still file the old style Form 1024 to ask for the IRS ruling on their exempt status. So remember, technically there are two filings for these organizations if you want to have a determination letter issued on their status, one of which will be filed to say, hey, we're going to be a C4. And then the other one will be filed to say, you know, IRS, will you rule that we are properly operating, that we are a proper tax exempt C4 organization? And that'll be part of their issue going forward. So be aware of that. Finally, we're going to consider the case of somebody who's come up before us before. This is the case of Mr. Topsnick versus Commissioner. You may remember earlier we saw him back in 2014 in the Topsnick case 143 TC number 12. So Mr. Topsnick has been before the tax court again, and this is very much related to the same problem he had before, and it's his second published tax court opinion. That's got to be some sort of record. By the way, he's not just been litigating in the tax court. There are a ton of cases. In fact, you can tell how many cases have been going on with him regarding this issue, because when the tax court refers to the earlier case, it actually, when it refers to it in the opinion, it'll refer to its earlier case as Topsnick 4. So there are like three other cases in other courts that have been involved with determining Mr. Topsnick's status and whether he owes tax and all the other neat things because he got a little bit, shall we say, sloppy. If you remember the original case, Mr. Topsnick is a German citizen, but he had been over in the U.S. as a legal permanent resident. He had that status in the U.S. He effectively unofficially terminated that status with immigration because he failed to comply to everything back in 2010. However, he never filed a formal withdrawal of the status. The regulations under the Internal Revenue Code written say you continue to be taxed as a U.S. resident until you formally terminate LPA status, which he did not do until 2014. So that started our problem. That was what the first case ruled, that he was still a U.S. resident, therefore subject to tax on his U.S. worldwide income by default and through 2014. Now, that would be the normal rule, except, of course, that if a treaty provides for a different result, then he might not have to pay tax on all of his income. In this particular case, now we're going to take a look at an installment sale that he signed back in 2004 that was to be paid to him over a number of years, and he was received payments all the way through 2013. The question that arises at this point is the nature of taxation of those amounts distributed to him, amount that he received, the installment sale in 2014. How much, if any, does he have to pay tax on of the gain that's in the installment sale at that point in time? And number two, can he get out of the whole thing? The U.S.-German treaty generally provides that if he was a resident of Germany for that year, then even though he may also be a resident of the U.S. and be subject to double tax, that he would not be subject to that tax in the U.S. per the treaty. He claimed, wait, I was a German resident in 2014. The court had a little problem with that. It turns out they went back and looked at a couple things. First thing they said, no, it looks like you're still here because you got no evidence you lived in Germany. And secondly, you told the German government that you should be taxed as a non-resident for German purposes, and you never filed income tax with Germany. And since the whole point of this treaty was to avoid double taxation, Mr. Topsnick, we don't think you're going to qualify for any relief there. Therefore, you are subject to tax on worldwide income in 2014. You can't escape tax on an installment sale gain. But it goes from bad to worse. You may remember, the problem is Mr. Topsnick, of course, abandoned his status in 2010. And that's all fine and good. But Congress passed in the interim some special rules that were meant to effectively tax people on when they abandon their U.S. citizenship or residency status in some cases. They would pay full tax as if everything was sold at fair value, the expatriation rules. Now, while those rules were not in place in 2004 when Mr. Topsnick signed the installment sale, they were in place in 2014, the year in which he terminated his LPA status. So the question becomes, is the remaining gain triggered? Do we have to treat this as a sale of the installment arrangement as of the date he lost his status? The tax court looks at a couple issues here to come into it. Number one, they say, first thing is he subject to this rule? He was found to be a covered expatriate. One of the ways you're a covered expatriate, he had LPA status, right? He had not filed properly his tax returns for the prior 5 years to the U.S. And number two, he didn't file a Form 8854 that certified that he had been in compliance. He hadn't filed the returns at all. So the fact is you become a covered expatriate in his status if you fail to file that form. And since he couldn't sign that form under penalty of perjury anyway, the fact he didn't file it kind of becomes moot because he didn't comply with his filing requirements. Therefore, the court found that Mr. Topsnick was taxable on the entire value of that. Mr. Topsnick said, well, this is unfair. This is considered to be imposing a tax after the fact. The tax court said, no. Congress told people who are U.S. residents or not, people who are U.S., who are subject to U.S. tax when they passed this rule, which was part of the HEROES Act back in, back around 2009, 2008 and 2009, as I recall. I think 2008 is the real year for the HEROES Act. It was part of that act. We were told at that point that we were going to start imposing a tax on a sale at fair value of the assets you held. That installment note is an asset you're holding at the end of the year, at the time you expatriated. Because you held it at the time you basically became no longer subject to U.S. tax in the future, we're treating you as selling that for its fair value. And the regulation says, by definition, an installment note is presumed to have a value equal to its face. So basically, we sold it for the entire face value the day before you left the country. Therefore, Mr. Topsnick is subject to tax on the entire gain. It's all triggered on his 2014 return. Not a good result. The real interesting part about all of this is when you go back to the original case, you realize that all of this is triggered because he didn't get his paperwork right back in 2010. Had he gotten his paperwork right back in 2010 when he was fully compliant, he wouldn't have triggered an acceleration of this gain. And looking at the U.S.-German treaty, almost certainly he wouldn't have paid tax on most of the installment gain because he would have been double taxed, but he would have been a German resident, presuming he moved to Germany. Now, again, I'm assuming that he actually eventually does tell Germany he's going to pay tax to them. That was also probably another not-so-good thing versus a treaty. But in any event, details matter, and that's somewhat important to understand when you're here and dealing with tax matters. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January 25th, 2016. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your state's SIF CPAs. Be sure to visit us online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where you'll get links to all the citations this week, including the source documents. Also, check out our website there as we give you updates that occur during the week. And I hope to see you next week when we come back and give you more information about what's been going on in the area of federal taxes. So I'll see you all in a week.